Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and sometimes more than daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So Parliament is not back quite yet. We have that joy tomorrow on Tuesday, but it's a busy day for the government thanks to the ongoing Iran crisis. James, what are the developments over the weekend? Boris Johnson returned from his holiday and put out a statement in which he said...
So there were two statements from Boris Johnson last night. One made on his own, which says that, you know, the UK does not kind of shed any tears for the death of the leader of the Iranian Al-Quds force. And then a joint statement from the UK, France and Germany kind of urging on everyone to kind of de-escalate the situation. And I think the interesting and striking thing about the second statement is how on this Iran question, where the US and the European Union have been quite divided in opinion, the UK, while being careful not to kind of formally break with the US, is still talking with more of a European accent. I also think the other thing, which as always, kind of Donald Trump is acting as a complicating factor here. You know, some of Trump's threats, you know, for example, to hit Iranian cultural sites if there is any Iranian retaliation, I think made the situation particularly difficult for Downing Street, because, you know, the normal Western rubric is quite rightly that the quarrel is not with the Iranian people, it's with the Iranian regime. When you start talking about hitting cultural sites, that becomes a slightly more difficult argument to make. But I do think there is one thing worth noting here, which is Iran has incredibly successfully over the last decade or so used proxy, or more than last decade, I should say, last two decades almost, has used proxies to, as you plausible deniability, kind of Hezbollah, for example, Shiite militias in Iraq, to advance its interests. This US strike makes that much harder for them to do. It is basically a willingness to say that you will hold them responsible for the actions of these proxies.
Fraser, we've had Boris Johnson suggesting he is not going to shed any tears when it comes to the death of the general, but also suggesting restraint in terms of focusing, instead of ramping tensions up, trying to find a solution. We've had the joint statement with Merkel and Macron, and we've also had comments from Dominic Raab. It does seem as though the government is, I suppose, not completely in tune with America here, which suggests that they want to actually, if anything, ratchet things up to ward off a future strike. Whereas on the UK side, we have this aim to de-escalate. Do you think that's going to create tensions?
It's already creating tension. In fact, this is a very interesting moment for Britain because we're about to leave the European Union. And the big question then is, what will then happen to Britain diplomatically? Will we stay in Europe's diplomatic orbit, or will we drift off to America's diplomatic orbit? Because typically, when push comes to shove, wherever there is a dictator to be toppled, Britain tends to align pretty firmly with America, with continental Europe not so much. Now, Iran is a classic case study of where Europe and America disagree. When Trump tore up the Iran deal, European states stuck by it. And until recently, Britain had been acting pretty, as James says, speaking with a European accent, standing by France and Germany over this. Now, this was slightly irritating Pompeo, who was the US State Secretary, who was saying a few days ago that what the Brits and the Germans need to understand is that this is basically de-escalation. We are taking out a bad guy who was causing turmoil world over. And America should get a bit more support on this. He wasn't quite saying choose your sides, but it sounded a little bit like that. Now, we had a fairly, I would say, non-committal statement from Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, on the Andrew Marr show. And I think that Boris Johnson's statement was a little bit more pro-American, more verbally supportive of Trump, while also having a second statement to do Europe. But this underlines the huge question that we will 2020 will give us the answer to. What are we going to do? Right now, Trump does see the world very differently. And is Britain going to find itself as, let's face it, we are America's number one ally in Europe. We always have been. This is what we mean when we say special relationship. And we're going to want to be seen to be that, especially as we're negotiating for a trade deal. I gather that the Americans are being very friendly with us right now, saying that they have got an oven-ready trade deal ready to go if things fall through with the EU. We're going to want to keep that option, which means being nice to America. Now, if Donald Trump starts to say that being nice to America means giving a lot more help with Iran, I suspect Britain will do that, and the distance between Britain and the rest of Europe and Iran will grow greater.
And we should perhaps get a clearer sign of what the UK government is attending later this week when Dominic Raab meets with Mike Pompeo in Washington, a pre-arranged talk, but clearly this is going to come up. Now, in terms of the Commons, the main action this week relates to the withdrawal agreement bill, which will be reintroduced tomorrow for committee stage and beyond. But today, the action is actually away from Parliament, and that is the Labour's NEC meeting. Labour's National Executive Committee are meeting to finalise the rules and the timetable for the Labour leadership contest. It may feel as though it's been going on for some time, but it hasn't actually started. James, what is up for discussion?
So what is up for discussion is the rules of the contest. So, e.g., first of all, the timetable, and then the question of, I think, probably the most contentious question of when people would have to have joined the Labour Party to have a vote in this. One of the things that various of the less Corbynite candidates are quite keen to do is to get lots of people who are not currently Labour members to sign up to an attempt to kind of
It's been a while since we recorded this podcast.
To essentially replicate what Jeremy Corbyn and the left achieved when he won the leadership, which is get a huge amount of people to come and join the party and change the nature of the electorate. And obviously, the tighter the timetable is, the more difficult that is to do. So I think we wait to see that. I'm struck by just how left-wing the candidates are positioning themselves. You know, people talked about Keir Starmer as a kind of great hope of the Labour moderates. You know, his video launching his leadership bid pitches him as, you know, firmly in the left of the Labour Party position, you know, making clear all of his disagreements with New Labour. I mean, this is, you know, in a sense, he is trying to say that he is in that video pitching himself as Corbynism without Corbyn almost. And that, I think, is an interesting question. Then you've got the kind of wild card candidate, Jess Phillips. I think she demonstrated yesterday with her statement about, you know, possibly leading a rejoin campaign. You know,
yeah, but she appears to now rode back on.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, this is why Jess Phillips is the high risk, high reward candidate for Labour in this election, because she speaks as she finds, so that's why she gave the answer she gave on Andrew Marr. But then that can sometimes cause you huge problems down the line, because, you know, is it really viable to fight the next election trying to reopen the Brexit issue? As you say in her piece this morning, she's rowing back from that position quite rapidly, trying to say, oh, I can't imagine that position would find support at the next election. But the danger for her is that when she does that kind of thing, she undercuts what's meant to be her USP, that she just calls it as she sees it.
And now, as we wait to find out the specifics on the time period you had to be a member for or a registered supporter, there are some things we know about the contest. So in order to reach the membership stage, each candidate needs to have 21 MPs backing them. They also need 3 affiliates, and that includes 2 unions. So actually, the first stage is harder to get through than I think some expect. People we think should sail through that round very comfortably: Keir Starmer, who topped the YouGov poll last week in terms of the general contest amongst Labour members, and Rebecca Long-Bailey, who hasn't yet announced, but we expect that to be imminent, and there is a sense that she definitely has the backing of unions and MPs. As for the other candidates, Fraser, is still slightly up for grabs. Lisa Nandy is clearly pitching herself as someone who can rebuild the red wall in terms of reuniting the Labour Party with its voters in traditional heartlands. Who do you think is sticking out to you as someone who the Tories would be worried about as a leader?
It's funny that the conventional wisdom is that the Tories would most worry about Keir Starmer. I really don't see it that way. I think he's somebody who goes through this sort of, he's presenting himself as a Corbynista, but he's actually an incredibly dull leader, I'm afraid to say. You need somebody interesting who's going to make people listen twice. I mean, and I actually think that Lisa Nandy is, I find her the most original, sparky. If I was Boris Johnson, obviously, what are you worried about? You're worried about Labour coming to win back these northern seats that gave you your majority. Is Keir Starmer going to do that? I really don't think so. I'm not quite sure that Rebecca Wrong-Daly would either. I think that Lisa Nandy would be the biggest kind of threat there. I think she everything that they've said so far about Labour's problems, I think only Lisa Nandy is one I thought to myself, yes, she really gets it. And she basically has got the vocabulary and the diagnosis to get Labour back on track. And remember, when I say back on track, I mean, I don't mean to win over Middle England. Partly the problem is since the Blair era, Labour have thought that, OK, what we're going to do is we're going to try to basically take the graduates and take the cities. And that's when the rot set in under Blair. You don't need a Blairite restoration now. You need to do something that's going to get these people back. And only then can Labour think about being a national party properly. So we'll see. My own hunch is that the next leader of a Labour Party will not fight the next general election. I think they're in such a mess right now, but they're going to have to find a kind of a caretaker, a continuity candidate, I don't know. I mean, I think that the next Labour Prime Minister will be somebody whose name we're not even discussing yet and who will take a few years to come through. So this is why I don't think we need to spend too much time worrying about this. I am intrigued about moderate entryism. You hear quite a lot of people saying now, join the Labour Party, look at this. Whereas if you want a sort of Blairite restoration, then join it now and let's try to impose a common sense candidate. I've got no idea if that can happen in the numbers that they require. Because the Labour problem right now is that the Corbynistas didn't just take over the leadership, they took over the membership. And I think to overcome that factor is going to take quite some time.
Yes, I was told by a Labour insider over the weekend that Jess Phillips could win the contest. She simply needs to get 130,000 people to join the Labour Party and then it's all hers. James?
I mean, there are two things here. One is the danger with moderate entryism is that the organising force that could get these people to join is the European question. And on that question, these people are not moderate in terms of where public opinion now is. I think, you know, the idea of rejoining is not a moderate position in this debate at the moment.
Yeah. I'm not even the Liberal Democrats feel unsure about
it. Yeah, and so I think that's the danger, which is the only force I think that could get enough people to join in time, you know, providing whatever the NEC schedule says, would be Europe. But the problem on Europe is that then takes you even further away from those voters in Blythe Valley because you are now an explicitly rejoined party. I think the person who number 10 would be most scared of is Dan Jarvis, because Dan Jarvis would flip the question around. He would deal with Labour's values problem, you know. You suddenly would have a former soldier, a widower, a guy motivated, all this, you know, he would be so different from Corbyn, he would force people to look at Labour in a different light. You know, he sits for a Barnsley seat, he's already, you know, a mayor up in Yorkshire. You know, this would have a hugely, it would make Labour not look like a North London party anymore. And it would change the nature of Labour. Labour would no longer be the party of the big cities. It would have a very different feel to it. But I don't see any signs that you know, of how, from you were talking about that, getting through that first round. I don't see how Dan Jarvis could get through that first round if he tried.
So he might be, James, somebody who might, you know, he might get in there if the next Labour leader fails, as I suspect will happen. Then Dan Jarvis might be. That's if the party is even in a fit state to start becoming national, because there's so much we don't know about Labour, whether it can even agree what it stands for right now. And it's interesting hearing even people like Stephen Kinnock using language like the party's got no God-given right to survive. Now, I remember where Tories used this language when they thought that the game was basically up, the Blair destroy them forever, that the movement would dissolve. Right now, the Labour Party's mission isn't to win next time, it's to survive through to 2022. By the way, I think that the British system means that the two parties, I think, will always pretty much survive. They might radically change their form, but they will always be there. I also agree with James that Dan Jarvis is somebody that Mary Wakefield interviewed him for the magazine about 6-7 years ago. And we thought then that, God, this is a guy that our readers would probably vote for. They'd be quite interested in what he has to say. I doubt this time many Labour members, as currently constituted, would be as interested.
And finally, briefly, just in the interest of fairness, there is one other party looking for a leader, and that is the Liberal Democrats. They're a rather depleted force, owing to the result and also the fact that Jo Swinson lost her own seat. Apparently, you actually only need one Lib Dem MP to back you in order to enter the race.
Can that be
because,
yourself?
Because the number, not yourself, I did check that, because the numbers are so low. So I just wanted from both of you who you thought would be the Liberal Democrat leader someone somewhere might be scared of.
Easy. Leila Moran. I would easily make her. I think she's the most interesting Lib Dem. Right now, you know, they're not going to make the Joe Swinson mistake of thinking we're going to be the next Prime Minister. You just need somebody who anybody would be interested in hearing from. And I never used to rate her that highly until I heard her on Women with Balls, Katie. So when you interviewed her, I thought, God, this woman really is, she's very interesting, she's quite original, she's quite sincere, and I think she would be, you know, a very interesting counterpoint to Boris Johnson and whoever Labour is going to. And I think none of the Labour candidates, to me, seem very interesting. Lena Moran, I would basically listen to whatever she had to say.
I have to say, you know, if we think Labour is in a bad place, I think the Lib Dems are in a worse place. You know, the last election should have provided them with the ideal conditions for a political recovery. And the fact that didn't happen, I think, is deeply worrying for them. I wonder whether, and this might sound totally absurd, I wonder whether they could do worse than going to one of their few successors of a night, Daisy Cooper, and say, right, you know, you do it. Because I do struggle to see who it is who is going to revive them as a force.
Yeah, just on Daisy Cooper, she's a Liberal Democrat MP for St Albans, and I was on the radio with her yesterday, and we asked her about whether she'd run for it. She won't rule it out, so she's clearly considering it. And she also said that she didn't think the Liberal Democrats should move to being a rejoin party, at least for the time being, and they should focus on other issues.
I do wonder if the Lib Dems will actually, you know, will they survive in their current form? Might they just decide to change the name completely? I've always had a theory with the Lib Dems. If this is a party that was created after Kylie Minogue's first hit single. And I've always wondered if this party, which is predated by Kylie's career, might actually be outlasted by it. Kylie's still going.
I would just say on that I have heard from a few pollsters, respected pollsters, that they actually think the Liberal Democrat result, in terms of long term, wasn't catastrophic. It actually sowed the seeds for a route to recovery where they could build and actually do quite well in 5-10 years. This was the brutal round, so to speak.
I think the Lib Dem result was very similar to the Tory result in 2017, a massive disappointment to the party. But actually, their problem was they were simply trying to win seats that they have a good chance of winning, but simply from too far behind you. And that meant that however close they got, as they did in kind of Dominic Raab's seat, for example, in Esher and Moulton, they were going to fall short, because it is very difficult to win a seat from a totally standing start, having no idea where your vote is.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And if you would like to listen to that Leila Moran episode, which Fraser kindly mentioned, do check it out. Just go to www.spectator.co.uk/balls, where that, along with all other Women with Balls episodes, are available. And do join us again tomorrow.